Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do the most resilient survivors of traumatic experiences have in common? It is entirely understandable when people who have lived through wars, natural disasters, and crippling illnesses are not able to function as well after a tragedy as before one. But as my guest today will tell us, all of us can be inspired by and take cues from the remarkable subset of people who find meaning and motivation in their hardships and actually emerge from terrible experiences stronger than before. David B. Feldman is Associate Professor of Counseling Psychology at Santa Clara University. His new book, written with co-author Lee Daniel Kravitz, is called Super Survivors: The Surprising Link Between Suffering and Success. David, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on.
This is a very optimistic book, given that most of us will eventually experience something deeply traumatic. What's the difference, though, between simply moving past a hardship and being what you define as a super survivor?
I think that most people are familiar with post-traumatic stress disorder, the nightmares and the flashbacks. And this is a real condition, as you mentioned in your intro, that causes a lot of pain for people. And it deserves real conversation and real treatment. But I think what most people aren't familiar with is the fact that PTSD only happens for about 20 to 30% of people who have encountered a trauma. Now, I want to contrast that with another statistic that a lot of people don't know, which is that in 50 to 80% of cases of trauma, people grow in some way. That may be as simple as seeing the sky as bluer and the grass is greener and the colors of the flowers is more vibrant. It can mean being closer to the people that you love, discovering new relationships, deepening in your spirituality. It can mean making new choices and taking your life in a new direction. And that happens for the vast majority of people who encounter trauma. Now, if you go one step further than that, we call people super survivors. These are people who make dramatic and lifelong, in some cases, changes to their lives in a positive way, often touching the world around them after trauma.
How long does the intensive period of post-traumatic growth tend to last for people?
Well, for the majority of people, it can last for a very, very long time. I think the realizations that you sometimes make in the aftermath of trauma, whether that's just deepening in a relationship, a lot of people say, I used to work with people who had very serious illnesses like cancer and heart disease, and they would often just say they discovered who their real friends were and deepen in their relationships with those friends. And those relationships may stay deepened and abiding for a very, very long time. So I think that these are not fake changes. They're very much real changes. But then again, there are super survivors who make much more dramatic changes, like some of them that you mentioned a few minutes ago. Alan Locke, for instance, was a fellow that we interviewed who was a Navy man. He was in the British Royal Navy. He was in his 20s. And the unthinkable happened. He went blind of macular degeneration, lost most of his vision in about a month, and subsequently lost his job in the Navy and fell into, a period of, who can blame him, depression and real anxiety about the future. But if you flash forward a few years, he becomes the first blind person to row a rowboat across the Atlantic Ocean and to trek across Antarctica. And he made the Guinness Book of World Records twice and has become an inspiration to millions. These are real dramatic changes that he and others we call super survivors make after trauma.
That's a great example of the fact that super survivors are not necessarily people who seem to come out of things unscathed. In fact, one of the things that tends to be important is that these individuals acknowledge and really cope with the horrible things that have happened to them.
That is absolutely correct. And I'm glad you mentioned it, because I think one of the ways that our message in this book can be misunderstood is that we are in some way saying that trauma is a good thing. And we're absolutely not saying that. Trauma is bad. period. People suffer mightily from trauma. And in fact, a lot of the people in our book went through periods of nightmares and emotional pain and still experience those from time to time, sometimes often. But I think that it's important to know that growth from trauma is not mutually exclusive with that pain, that often that pain, that suffering can fuel our looking at our lives, our process of looking inward and saying, okay, this has happened to me. I can't necessarily go back and hit the reset button and, in the case of Alan, you know, bring my vision back. Or in the case of others, you know, we interviewed a guy who lost his leg when he was only 17. There's nothing that could bring that back, and there's no time machine. But he looked at his life and said, what am I going to do now? How am I going to build a better life, the best life I can, on top of this, given where I am? That's a concept that we call grounded hope, and we come back to over and over again.
And grounded hope is about, again, rather than focusing on what you have lost and wishing that the impossible were true, it's saying, okay, here's where I am at this moment, whether I expected or wanted to be here or not, where do I go?
Exactly. And that is, I think, one of the keys. I mean, we go through many principles in the book, but one of the things that unites pretty much all the super survivors we interviewed was this sense that they looked at their situation very realistically. They avoided the temptation to deny or distort reality. And because that feels good in the short term, but in the long term, if you're denying or distorting what has happened to you and telling yourself that everything will just be okay, that makes it really hard to actually bounce forward and create a new life for yourself. So all of them accepted what they could not change. And that sounds depressing, but they all told us, and the research, by the way, backs this up, they all told us that by accepting what they cannot change, they could more clearly see what they could change and begin to ask themselves that forward-looking, hopeful question, how can I build a better life on top of this? And so in the book, we're certainly not saying that trauma is in any way good, but we are saying that human beings have the amazing capacity to transform suffering into success, to somehow transcend that suffering and create amazing lives for themselves.
So if growth can come out of suffering, and if we, you know, agree, we sort of stipulate that tragedy is horrible and that it is not a good thing. But I wonder what all this suggests about the tendency we have to, for example, throw medication at people whose depression may not be pathological, but maybe in fact be tied to a traumatic event in their lives. Does blunting the effects of that keep people from fully experiencing what growth might come out of their suffering?
Well, let me first say that I am not a medical doctor. Mm-hmm. I am a psychologist, and so I may not be exactly the right person to ask about medication and the biology. What I can tell you is that it is very possible to make dramatic changes to your life when you're on medication. In fact, in some cases, I think certainly I have seen cases in my own practice in the past where being on medication actually was helpful to people in being able to free them up from some of the intense anxiety and depression, to be able to ask themselves, well, what kind of a future do I want to create for them, for myself? I don't think people need to be on that medication forever, certainly. But there's also research that shows that in some cases, medication can do what you said, that it can blunt the affect, particularly if it's misprescribed. So I think the important thing is to have a doctor who really knows what he or she is doing.
How did you and your co-author, Lee Daniel Kravitz, go about searching for people and identifying people who met the criteria to be called super survivors?
Well, first we started with the research. So I'm a professor and I'm a researcher, and I've done a lot of research on hope and on how people establish a meaningful life in the wake of tragedy. And so we dove deeply into the research. And in this book, we have 25 pages of references, of bibliography. And we really asked ourselves, what are scientists, social scientists, finding about what enables people to bounce forward? And we identified a set of 8 principles that are based on very, very good studies. And then we began to identify people who exemplified those principles. We actually interviewed over 100 people that we found often by Googling them and looking at TED Talks and looking on YouTube. And we would contact them via email and say, you know, would you be willing to be interviewed for this book? And I think the interesting thing for me was that almost everyone said, oh, no, I'm not a super survivor. They were very humble. I'm just an ordinary person who did what anyone would do in my circumstances. You should really talk to my friend who's a super survivor. And then we would take those names and we would talk to those friends and they would say, oh, no, we're not super survivors. And we just followed the tentacles of these different references out until we identified 17 of them that we thought really exemplified in a heartwarming and dramatic way and clear way what super survival is and how people achieve it. Our hope is that everyone who reads this book will connect in a visceral way with one or many of the super survivors and be able to sort of change their lives, to pattern themselves in some way off of these super survivors and make use of what they have learned.
It's one thing to be deeply and horribly affected by something that happened as an act of nature or an accident. People have another level to sort of get beyond when whatever has damaged them was caused by another person.
Oh, yes. So psychologists have studied, you know, what traumas are the most traumatic. That may sound strange because, of course, they're all traumatic. But it turns out that interpersonal traumas, traumas that are in some way purposely inflicted by another person, are the most damaging psychologically. Now, a lot of the super survivors we interviewed encountered interpersonal traumas. But these have a much higher rate of post-traumatic stress disorder and of a lot of negative symptoms. Interestingly, though, there's also some indication that they also have a higher rate of post-traumatic growth, because often going through that pain can be the catalyst for sort of forcing yourself to look inward and grow. But yes, those are very, very damaging. And the truth is that a lot of times traumas are perpetrated by people that we're close to, people that we thought we knew, people that even sometimes we loved. And that's an incredibly painful fact of life. And as you said, the majority of us will have traumas in our life. Something like 60 to 80% of us at some point during our long lives will encounter a trauma, a serious trauma. So this is something I think that as sort of taboo or painful as it is to think about and talk about, I think it's something we're thinking about. How do we want to handle that if that strikes?
Why is forgiveness so useful?
Particularly for interpersonal traumas, forgiveness is incredibly important. We tell the story of a woman named Clementine Wymariah in the book. This is she was a girl at the time, maybe 10 years old, living in Rwanda with her family. And this was about 20 years ago at the time of the Rwandan genocide. And she narrowly escaped being killed. And in fact, her family was massacred. And she and her sister clung to each other, her young sister clung to each other and bounced from refugee camp to refugee camp, just horrible places full of sexual assault and disease and starvation. And eventually they made it to the United States as refugees. Now, this is a terrible beginning to this story. I mean, just I can't imagine going through what she went through.
And I'm going to put you at a terrible cliffhanger because we have to take a quick break here. So the story does get better. We'll leave people with that. We'll be back in just a minute with David B. Feldman. He's Associate Professor of Counseling Psychology at Santa Clara University and co-author, along with Lee Daniel Kravitz, of the new book Super Survivors, The Surprising Link Between Suffering and Success. If you'd like to ask a question, maybe tell your own super survivor story, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration opens August 5th. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with David B. Feldman, Associate Professor of Counseling Psychology at Santa Clara University and co-author of the new book Super Survivors, The Surprising Link Between Suffering and Success. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. David, before the break, you set us up with the story of Clementine Wamaraya, and I'm so glad that we're telling this story because it's really astonishing. Tell us about what happened in her life during the Rwandan genocide and after.
So after she narrowly escaped the genocide and her family being murdered, she bounced from refugee camp to refugee camp. And flash forward a number of years, she makes it to the United States as a refugee. And now, 20 years later, she is a graduate of Yale. She has been appointed by Obama to the Holocaust Memorial Council. She lectures for the UN on genocide and factors related to that. And she travels the world. She works alongside Oprah Winfrey at the Leadership Academy for Girls. Just an incredible transformation. And you asked about forgiveness. And we asked her about what helped her to bounce forward and become a super survivor. And she told us that one of the most important things was forgiveness, that she forgave what happened to her. But I think she said, and we agree, and 20 years of research agrees, that in general, the public misunderstands what is meant by forgiveness. I think a lot of people think that forgiveness is a gift that you give to the perpetrators, the gift of pardon or clemency. I think sometimes also people think that it means forgetting. And Clementine said that for her, it wasn't either of those. Her perpetrators didn't even know that she had forgiven. And in fact, she's never forgotten. She lectures to the UN about genocide and what happened to her. But she said that forgiveness is not a gift you give to the perpetrator. It's a gift you give to yourself. It's permission to let go of the anger and the hurt and the pain of the past and to turn your sights forward and put one foot in front of the other to create a better future. I love the saying, forgiveness is giving up the hope that the past could be any different. Hmm. It's saying to yourself, you know what? I don't have a time machine to change the past, but I do have the power. If I can unshackle myself from some of that pain and suffering from the past, I do have the power to create a better future. And that's exactly what Clementine is doing.
Can you talk about what happened when she went on the Oprah Winfrey Show for the first time?
Sure. This was quite an Oprah moment. So she was under the impression that she had lost her whole family. She had heard screams in the night when she escaped out the back window of her grandparents' house. And she was sure that her whole family had been murdered. In fact, her grandparents had been murdered. But it turns out her parents hadn't. And the way that she discovered that they hadn't was that she went on the Oprah Winfrey Show. She actually was a teenager, and she entered the Oprah Winfrey essay contest for essays about the Holocaust because she saw this as one of her ways of bouncing forward, of making the world a better place, was to write about genocide. And she wrote this really moving essay about the connection between the genocide that she witnessed and the genocide during World War II. And Oprah chose her as a winner of this essay contest, had her on the show. And during the show, Oprah revealed that she and her producers had found Clementine and Clementine's sister's parents. And a panel slid open on the stage and out walks her parents. And she literally falls over. Mm-hmm. It's an incredible moment. You can see it streamed on the web. And she says that this certainly helped her to forgive. That knowing her parents were alive helped her to see the world as maybe not so much of a horrible place as she thought it was. But actually, she's very clear that her journey towards forgiveness and turning her sights forward towards the future and letting go of that hope that the past could be different, accepting the past as it is, really started many, many years earlier as well.
So there's really interesting research to show that people who are able to forgive ultimately tend to be healthier, they tend to be happier, they tend to be more successful. I wonder, though, David, if there's a sort of chicken and egg question as to causation. Are people who are sort of wired happier more easily able to forgive?
I think it's an interesting question, and this is a problem that, you know, we have in a lot of social science research. And what you're referring to is there was a large study done a number of years ago. They interviewed, or rather surveyed, 10,000 Americans, representative sample from across the U.S. And it turns out that people who were more willing to forgive, who said that they tended not to hold grudges or harbor unforgiveness, as psychologists sometimes call it, those folks had lower rates of heart attack and heart disease. They had lower blood pressure. They had fewer stomach ulcers, less arthritis, back problems, headaches. The list is actually pretty long. But that's a good question. Are they able to forgive because they naturally are just happier people and they naturally have better health and that somehow frees them up more to feel better and forgive? Or is it the forgiveness that helps them to have better health mentally and physically? I don't think we have a certain answer to that question, but there have been studies where they bring mostly college students. Those are the universal guinea pigs of social science research. Bring college students into a lab. Have them think about a recent time when people have wronged them, when someone has wronged them. And then they encourage the college students during a 5 to 10 minute period to either dwell on the way they've been wronged and think about all the ways that they were in pain and had been wronged, or they ask them, on the other hand, to dwell on forgiveness, to think about trying to take a little bit the perspective of the perpetrator, trying to understand maybe why the perpetrator did what they did, not to forget or pardon them, but just to try to understand, and then to think about how they're going to move forward in their lives with forgiveness. And it turns out that the people who do that versus think about grudge holding, the people who do that during that 10-minute period have lower blood pressure, have lower tension in their body, and feel better emotionally. So forgiveness does seem to have some power if we can do it. I don't think that we should be in the business of forcing ourselves or anyone else to forgive. I think to force someone to forgive when they're not ready is to re-victimize them. I think that people need to forgive when they naturally come to it. But the research is pretty clear that for people who do that naturally, it's a good choice for them.
I want to talk about how super survivors orient their thinking in time. Can you talk about like the functional difference between looking ahead mostly in one's life and looking toward what has passed?
Yeah, that's one of the things that we found with this. And we've been talking about it with forgiveness, that to a certain degree, harboring a grudge is looking to the past. It's staying shackled to the past. And by the way, I think we can harbor a grudge against a situation. I know that sounds odd, but I think all of us have had times in our lives, and we all know people who have as well, who get really yoked to the past, who ruminate about it, and who tell themselves that because something in the past happened to them, there's no way that they can ever have a good life again. And I don't mean to belittle in any way the impact of trauma and the pain that so many people have in their past. I have my share of pain as well. Everyone does. But I think that when people can, to a certain degree, move their sights to the future and ask themselves that grounded hope question, this is the past. I can't necessarily change that. Can I accept it in some way, though? And ask myself, how can I create a better future? And a lot of the folks that we interviewed said that, in fact, the past informed their future, that maybe they gained greater empathy or insight. Maybe they understood the world and themselves and other people in a better way as a result of going through a painful time. They were able to use some of those insights to create a better life. And I think that does mean looking to the future while not forgetting the past.
And as it turns out, it doesn't hurt to have a little bit of delusion with regard to how much agency we have over the rest of our lives.
Yeah. So we interviewed a guy named Casey Peretti, just an amazing fellow. This is a guy I mentioned a few minutes ago who was a teenager. I think he was 19, actually. And he was back from his first summer after his first year in college. And he was out with some friends, and they were driving an old tricked-out car. And it stalled by the side of the road, and they couldn't get it restarted. So Casey got out and started to push. And as he was pushing the car up the road, a drunk driver skid across the road and hit the back bumper, slicing his leg off. And he lost his leg permanently. Now, you flash forward a number of years, Casey ends up doing an amazing thing. He ends up getting a prosthetic leg. He ends up learning how to rollerblade, and he rollerblades across America, raising money for a limb bank for kids to give people who can't afford it, to give their children artificial limbs. He also now is one of the most sought-after stuntmen in Hollywood, and his specialty, not surprising, is getting his leg blown off because he can do that. Mm. And if you talk to him, you find that this is an incredibly confident person. A lot of people would say a little bit, slightly delusionally confident. He believes that no matter what life throws at him, no matter what, because we can't always control what life throws at us, but no matter what life throws at him, he can bounce forward. He can handle it. He can create a good life for himself, and he can accomplish anything that he wants. And it turns out that having that slight sense of overconfidence, sometimes it's called a positive illusion of control, is actually a really good thing for people. We psychologists normally think of delusions as bad, but this happens to be a slight illusion of control. And people who have this tend to have lower rates of depression, lower rates of anxiety. We've seen that they tend to bounce back and forward more from trauma because, again, they accept through grounded hope that they can't always control what happens to them, but they believe that they can, no matter what, create a better future for themselves.
And that's an outgrowth of saying, okay, I've survived this thing that seemed like the worst thing in the world at the time, and I'm okay now. So if something else happens, I'll be all right. Is that it?
Yeah, I think for Casey, it certainly was. That he said, look, I've lived through the worst, one of the worst possible things that I can imagine. I'm not afraid to take risks. I'm not afraid to try new things. I'm not afraid to fail. That was something we heard a lot from our super survivors, that I'm not afraid to make mistakes because I've lived through something horrible and I've survived. So I'm going to try different things. And if I fail, I fail. And if I succeed, well, won't that be marvelous? So there is this slight sense of, I guess, fearlessness that people come across after, some people at least, after living through a trauma.
David, how do super survivors attach meaning to the suffering that they have endured?
One way is through the accomplishments that they achieve. A lot of people after trauma will say that they feel very groundless. In a sense, a trauma is a double whammy. First, you suffer because of the pain of having lived through the trauma, but secondly, you suffer because oftentimes what you thought you believed about the world seems to be shattered. You know, we all, on some level, and research backs this up, those of us that were raised in, you know, relatively decent, all homes are dysfunctional, but relatively decent homes, tend to believe that the world is a pretty safe place, where most of the time good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. It's why we have sayings like, what goes around comes around. But trauma shatters that. Because something horrible just happened to us and we're pretty good people. And so a lot of times people feel very groundless. I'm reminded of Paul Rykoff, who is a fellow who enlisted in the military when he was just fresh out of college and wanted to go over to Iraq to make the world a better place. And when he got to Iraq, he, of course, saw many horrors and many people that he loved, that he cared about, injured, wounded, killed. And he also, he began to feel traumatized. And this really shook his faith in the world, his faith in the goodness of humanity, and to a certain degree, his faith in the country. Flash forward a number of years, he is now the founder of the IAVA, the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, one of the largest support groups in many ways, practical, psychological, physical health of vets, just an amazing transformation. And he says that that came through his process of trying to figure out what the world means now. And he decided that the world wasn't as safe and wasn't as good as he once thought it was. And so he determined to make it better. He determined to say, okay, I was a little naive before about my sense of safety and goodness of other people in the world. But you know what? I can do something about that. And he began to found this NGO, and he began to appear in the media, and he began to advocate for veterans. And I think that sometimes that process of meaning-making after trauma can send us in new directions in our lives.
Do people have a leg up on creating meaning from trauma if they have religious faith as a big part of their lives?
Religious faith is an interesting thing. I'm a religious person, I certainly have seen my share of circumstances in my own life where faith has been very important in helping me to be resilient. I think that people tend to become very polarized on this issue. You've got people who say, you know, religion is just a good thing. Everybody should have it. It helps people to cope with everything. And then I think you have the people on the other end who say religion is bad. It's horrible for our society. Everyone should get rid of it. I think both of these positions are probably a bit extreme. The research at least shows that it really depends on what the beliefs are. You know, like anything else in our lives, there are many different kinds of religious belief. And some can be very comforting and some can be very painful. There was a study a few years ago that showed that people with advanced HIV disease who believe that God is a judging and vengeful God tended to have lower health indicators. They tended to have a higher viral count. They tended to have worse immune functioning. And people who tended to believe that God was loving and forgiving tended to have better health indicators and a better, more healthy immune system. So I think it depends on what the beliefs are, and that shouldn't surprise us. There is such diversity in the religious community, and it matters what you believe.
We're speaking this hour with David B. Feldman. He is Associate Professor of Counseling Psychology at Santa Clara University and co-author, along with Lee Daniel Kravitz, of the new book Super Survivors, The Surprising Link Between Suffering and Success. If you'd like to ask a question or tell a story, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with courses in art, literature, history, communication, photography, and Portuguese. Fall registration opens August 5th. Registration and information at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David B. Feldman. He's Associate Professor of Counseling Psychology at Santa Clara University and co-author of Super Survivors, The Surprising Link Between Suffering and Success. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. David, we have in this country a great respect for rugged individualism, but it turns out that super survivors are able to accept help when they need it.
Social support is one of the most robust protective factors in the aftermath of trauma. There's probably 3 or 4 decades of research that shows that's true. But there's an interesting twist here, and that is it's possible to be surrounded by people who love us and care for us and want to help us, but not realize it and not perceive it. I think we all know people who have had this experience. You know, trauma can be incredibly alienating. And in the aftermath of trauma, sometimes people kind of withdraw from others and believe no one could ever possibly understand what we're going through. So you can be in a virtual sea, in the middle of a virtual sea of support, and believe you're in a desert. So the research is clear that what's important isn't how many people are around you to care for you. What's important is whether you realize they're there, whether you're open to their support and whether you call on them. And that's an important thing, I think, for us all to keep in mind at those times when we feel alone, is to really look around and call on the people who do want to be there for us.
What does it take to cultivate the kinds of relationships now that could serve us well in the event of a trauma?
Honestly, this is going to sound corny, but be yourself, be loving, help other people when they need help, and be there for others. But I think what's more important is at that moment when you feel like you don't want to call on the help of others, remind yourself how important it is to be open to the help of other people. I used to work with people who had very serious physical illnesses clinically. These are people who in some cases were dying of cancer and other serious illnesses. And I can't tell you how many people I heard say, well, I have lots of friends and family members, but I don't want to burden them. They might not understand what I'm going through. I'll just suffer alone and try to take care of myself the best I can. That is the time, if you ever find yourself thinking that, to really remind yourself how important reaching out is. And, you know, it's psychologically, at least, you don't have to ask a lot of people in order to feel supported. Sometimes it's just asking someone to talk on the phone for half an hour or writing an email and getting into an email exchange. It's what's important is to know that there are people out there who love you, to perceive that there are people there to support you. That sense of being held by the emotions of other people turns out to be the most important factor in helping people to be resilient when bad things are happening.
Okay, so let's flip that around. How do we take care of someone that we care about, that we might be close to and we might be just marginally close to, but someone that we would like to help? So many times people say, call me if there's anything I can do. The call never comes, and so that's that.
Yeah, I think to a certain degree, we can't force people to call us, right? Mm-hmm. And we can't force our help on other people. But I think making sure that people very clearly know that we are there for them, that we really mean it, suggesting to them things that we would like to do for them rather than waiting for them to suggest them to us. This is something that I always do when I have friends who are suffering, is I say, I'd really like to be there for you. Here are some things that I can do. I don't have to do them, but I'd be happy to do any of these or other things. And I suggest some things. And this reminds me of the story we talk about in our book of Cindy Sheehan. She was a young woman in her 20s, a party girl, for lack of a better word. She was out boating. She lived in Arizona, in the Phoenix area. She was out boating on a lake, and she was basically inner tubing behind a boat, going very fast, and the boat turned too quickly and slammed her head into the hull of an oncoming boat, sending blood cascading into the water and causing her a serious brain injury. She went into a coma for a month. And during that month, a lot of people who were her friends, she had many, many friends as a sort of party girl type, many of her friends came into the hospital, and she was in a coma, but said, we love you, you can pull out of it. The doctors eventually said, well, she's probably not going to pull out of it. So people started coming to say goodbye. But then, amazingly, because these things happen, she woke up. But when she woke up, she couldn't speak. She couldn't do math. She was confused. She didn't know where she was. She didn't realize that she was the owner of a company called Brandables that made promotional products. This was her job. She didn't remember any of this. And her friends didn't know how to deal with her. They didn't know how to connect with her. They felt awkward around her. So one by one, they began to peel away. They began to withdraw and not call anymore and not come by anymore. The interesting thing is that even as her friends began to sort of turn their backs, two people remained there for her fiancé and her mother. And they were there for her every day. They didn't necessarily know how to help. They didn't necessarily know what to do. Who could know as a caregiver in this situation? But they were there. They called every day or they came by every day. And so she credits her eventual recovery. She did recover most of her brain functioning. And Eventually, she turned her company, Brandables, into a multi-million dollar company during the financial downturn. This all happened during the financial downturn when companies were going out of business left and right in the Phoenix area, one of the hardest hit areas. She credits all of this to just knowing that they were there. Did they always do the right thing? Of course not. They always know what to do? Of course not. But they were always there, and she always knew it. And that gave her that sense of cushion to be able to really try to rehabilitate herself and to take risks in rehabilitating her company at the same time.
Do people, once they have sort of begun to turn the corner, I wonder how much of that progress serves as an impetus for further progress as people are becoming super survivors?
I think it does in a big way. It's sort of the snowball effect. I do think that when we as human beings see ourselves make a little progress, it gives us motivation to make more progress. And there's, again, loads of research that shows that that's true. And that's one of the reasons why psychotherapists are into baby steps. And maybe you've heard this idea that, you know, you get better through baby steps. You put one foot in front of the other. And that's what we mean by grounded hope, this principle in the book. Accept what you can't change about a situation. Ground yourself in reality. And then ask yourself, given where I am in life, where do I want to be? And begin to set goals and marshal your personal strengths, because we all have different ones, to put one foot in front of the other and take one step at a time towards the better future that you want. And what a lot of people find, and what the super survivors told us, is seeing themselves making a little progress gave them more motivation, more hope, to be able to put the next step forward and the next step forward, and eventually to do all the amazing things we've been talking about during this hour.
Do super survivors have a different perspective on success and failure than maybe the rest of us do?
Yeah, I think they do. Of course, I don't want to make any overgeneralizations, mm-hmm. because everybody is unique and everyone's situation is unique. But we certainly heard time and again, I'm not as afraid to take risks. I'm not as afraid to fail as I once was. There's a fellow we interviewed for the book called Marshall Goldsmith. And Marshall Goldsmith is a corporate coach who works with people who are, you know, CEOs. And one of the things that he does is he spends enormous amounts of time in CEOs' boardrooms and even in their homes and going to eat with them. And one of the things that he told us when we interviewed him is all of these CEOs are delusional. they believe that they are going to succeed no matter what. And of course, what's really interesting is they don't. If you look at the vast majority of careers, particularly here, if you look in Silicon Valley, where I'm sitting now, people have startups. They have startup after startup after startup, and they create app after app after app for smartphones and for computers, and most of them fail. But they're not afraid to fail, so they keep trying. They see failure as a stepping stone along the road to eventual success, and then they hit it with one app or with one creation or with one thing that they make, and then they end up making their fortunes. And I do think that some of the super survivors have this attitude that, you know, I survived something I never imagined I could survive, and here I am. So I'm not as afraid to live fully. I'm not as afraid to take chances. I'm not as afraid to go after my dreams and my goals. I think that's one of the messages that super survivors have for us is, don't wait for trauma and tragedy to wake us up to pursuing our dreams. Yeah, we may fail, but you definitely won't succeed if you don't try.
You have a sort of a mathematical formula in the book, by the way, for grounded hope, and that is a realistic view of the situation plus a strong view of one's ability to control one's destiny through one's efforts equals grounded hope.
Absolutely. So we asked some of the survivors, what helped you to bounce forward? And one of the curious things they told us was what didn't help them to bounce forward. A lot of them said what didn't help us to bounce forward was positive thinking. And of course, we thought, what? And we asked more questions. And the research backs this up as well, by the way, that, for instance, they would say, in the aftermath of trauma, a lot of my friends told me, Think positively. Look for the silver lining. Martin van der Weeden was a teenager when he got diagnosed with leukemia. And he was a swimmer, teenage swimmer. And a lot of his friends said, just don't think about the leukemia. The doctors said you have a 30% chance of survival, which is really low. And his friends and family would say, don't think about that. Only think about the positive. Just smile and be happy. And Martin said he couldn't do that he didn't feel positive. And a lot of people in the aftermath of trauma just don't feel positive. So does that mean they're doomed? If positive thinking is that powerful? We don't think so. What Martin said got him through was a realistic view of the situation. He talked to the doctors. As a teenager, he did research on leukemia. He began to read about how to make himself better. He said, look, if I've only got a 30% chance of survival, I need to accept that as fact and not paint a smiley face over it. But he began to set goals and put one foot in front of the other and do a little bit each day, get up and walk across the room. Eat a new thing, eat a little healthier, talk to his doctor and every chance he could get to try to make sure he was part of that 30% who would survive. And he did survive. So that's this really grounded, realistic view of the situation, together with that confidence that he had. Even though I need to accept the reality of what's happening to me, darn it, I can do things to make sure that this ends up the best that it could possibly be. Now, flash forward. He was a swimmer, and he knew that he wasn't the strongest swimmer, he wasn't the fastest swimmer, he wasn't the most athletically gifted swimmer, but he wanted to win. So he took this same sense of a realistic approach, admitting to himself he's not the most talented, together with confidence that he can start to set goals and practice in new ways that will make him as successful as possible. He took this to his swimming. And you know what? He ended up being an Olympic gold medalist in swimming for the Netherlands, all through this idea of grounded hope. A realistic appraisal of your situation, together with the confidence that you can take steps to make it better.
It's ultimately so much more empowering than positive thinking, which boils down to like wishing for a miracle in many cases.
Yeah, exactly. And I think positive thinking is definitely better than negative thinking, and wishful thinking is definitely better than being a cynic. But I think that this middle road of grounded hope may be the most powerful of all.
Can we do anything to prepare ourselves? I guess read the book and just be more appreciative of the things we have that are working for us? How does that work?
I think definitely read the book. in addition to that, I think there are kind of four things that we can do, and they recap a lot of what we've talked about this hour. First of all, be realistic. When bad stuff happens, avoid the tendency to deny or distort it. It may make you feel good temporarily, but it makes bouncing forward a lot harder in the long run. Second of all, don't be afraid to try different things. Nobody knows what ultimately is going to allow us to be resilient. So try many different things and don't be afraid to fail.
Just give me the last two bullet points because we're running out of
time
here.
Third, focus on what you can change and work towards that. And last, notice and call upon the people that are there for you. These are things that we can all start to do in our lives that will ultimately enable us to bounce forward after trauma.
The new book by David B. Feldman, my guest, and his co-author Lee Daniel Kravitz is called Super Survivors, The Surprising Link Between Suffering and Success. David, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thanks very much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Alsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.